Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl.
And I'm June.
Today we're covering part two in our series on the Arvizo allegations.
For all source material for this episode, please visit our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
You'll be hearing again from voice actor Derek Black, who is helping us narrate our episodes on the Arvizo case.
In the last episode, you heard how police and DA Tom Snedden arrest Michael Jackson, raid his home, put out a special phone line to identify more victims, and disparage him publicly, all based on the uncorroborated stories of the Arvizo family, a family with a history of manipulation and deceit.
In this part two, you'll hear how the trial begins in February 2005, and then we turn our attention to the testimony from the Arvizo family.
On February 24th, after 5 days of jury selection, 4 men and 8 women are confirmed. There are 7 white jurors, 4 Hispanic jurors, and 1 juror of Asian descent. There are no black jurors.
Before we move on to the trial proceedings, we're going to introduce the lawyers involved in the case and briefly cover their opening arguments to the jury.
The lawyers for both the prosecution and the defense were considered the best in their field, and both sides gave the case 100% of their time and effort. So their best evidence really means something. There's no issue of incompetent or indifferent lawyers to complicate the assessment of the Arvizo case.
The prosecution team is described as powerful and savvy by the press and legal experts, and includes Santa Barbara District Attorney Tom Snedden and Deputy District Attorneys Ron Zonin and Gordon Auchincloss.
We've already discussed Tom Snedden and how he's considered the most powerful man in Santa Barbara, and is described by peers as aggressive and determined, with a tendency to let his emotions drive his professional behavior.
Ron Zonin is widely regarded as the best trial lawyer in the county in 2005. Journalist Aphrodite Jones writes that, unlike the rage-filled Snedden, Zonin is sharp and always in control. Gordon Auchincloss is also a well-respected deputy district attorney, but plays a less prominent role at trial than the other two.
The defense team includes lead attorneys Tom Mesereau and Susan Yu. Although Yu does not question witnesses at trial, Mesereau calls her the most important lawyer on the team, working behind the scenes to research, write, and coordinate with the other attorneys in preparation for trial. Also on defense is Robert Sanger, an attorney unconnected to Mesereau who worked for Jackson for a number of years before the trial, and Mesereau describes him as exceptional.
Brian Oxman is another attorney initially part of Jackson's defense. Oxman is an example of the self-promoters that Mesereau saw all around Jackson when he was first hired as lead attorney. Even though he has no criminal defense experience and was not well regarded by other attorneys, Oxman manages to get into the case through his work for other Jackson family members. News reports describe how Oxman always finds his way in front of the TV cameras. Oxman is seen sleeping at trial on several occasions, makes some costly mistakes at Jackson's expense, and is fired by Mesereau partway through the trial.
On February 28, 2005, Jackson's criminal trial opens, and Tom Snedden begins the proceedings with his opening statements.
Snedden details the Arvizo's charges against Jackson, which you'll hear later in this episode through their direct testimony. Snedden asserts that Jackson wooed Gavin with gifts and his fame, and gave him alcohol to loosen him up before molestation. He says the Bashir documentary was a train wreck for Jackson, and Jackson and his team were in a panic to get the Arvizos to do the rebuttal video, which is why they held the family captive at Neverland. Snedden describes acts of molestation that occur near the end of their stay at the ranch.
Defense attorney Tom Mesereau follows with his opening statement, in which he lays out the defense's case for Jackson's innocence. He particularly focuses on the family history of fraud and grift. He details how Janet Arvizo had made 2 prior false imprisonment charges, 3 prior sexual allegation charges, terrorist charges, and Mesereau says he has witnesses who can testify to how Janet has referred to the killers many times in the past, as she does in the Jackson case.
Mesereau also tells the jury in his opening argument that it was Janet Arvizo herself who requested security by Jackson because of how the media was hounding her family. This is in contrast to the prosecution claim that Jackson's associates were conspiring through their many phone calls to force the Arvizos to do the rebuttal video by threats and holding them captive.
Mesereau doesn't disagree that there are many phone calls between Janet Arvizo and Jackson's associates, but not because they were holding her kids hostage, but because Janet Arvizo wanted distribution rights on the rebuttal video before she would agree to it. And right after the rebuttal taping, when Janet Arvizo realizes she isn't getting any money, Mesereau says that this is when the allegations start to form. Janet met privately with a civil attorney the day after the rebuttal video, never mentioning any issues of captivity or distress. Reporter Aphrodite Jones attends the entire trial, and in her book Conspiracy, she describes an atmosphere of incessant gossiping by the court press and says the media talks about Jackson behind his back like he was a clown.
There are about 140 total witnesses that will testify at trial, with 87 for the prosecution and about 53 for the defense.
For context, I found that the average number of witnesses in a criminal trial is less than 10, for both the defense and the prosecution. And the typical criminal trial lasts a few days to a few weeks, versus the 4 months for the Michael Jackson trial. The 140 witnesses is similar only to other very high-profile cases, such as the O.J. Simpson trial, which included about 130 witnesses over 8 months.
Today's episode will focus exclusively on the testimony of the Arvizo family, and the following episode will cover the rest of the prosecution witnesses.
Gavin's sister, Davalyn Arvizo, is called to testify on March 3rd as the prosecution's fourth witness. She's around 18 at the time of the trial.
Davalyn testifies to seeing Jackson share his Diet Coke can with Gavin on the flight back to L.A. from Miami, passing it back and forth, implying that Jackson was giving Gavin alcohol.
Davalyn says that once at Neverland, her mother never left her room, which will contradict the testimony of many Neverland employees, who say she regularly walked the grounds and joined the family for dinners in the main house.
Davalyn says she and her mom were scared and wanted out of Neverland, but never says why they didn't call for help, as her mom was regularly talking to her boyfriend, Major J. Jackson, and could freely make calls from her room.
Mesereau lists all the stores they visited during their stay at Neverland, and Davalyn confirms they never asked for help or said they were in distress on these outings. She says she and Gavin were given wine by Jackson at Neverland and says it tasted weird because she had no prior knowledge of liquor and wouldn't have known what wine tasted like.
Davalyn's account of never having alcohol before will contradict several later witnesses who say they saw Davalyn drinking alcohol without Jackson's influence, including the flight attendant, who says she served Davalyn and Marie Cassio alcohol on the flight back from Miami.
Later in her testimony, Davalyn says at all times when the boys were not with Jackson, they were with her, which contradicts her earlier testimony saying they were not together at all during the Neverland stay and that she was always alone.
Now, the Arvizos and the prosecution have expressed how despicable it was that Jackson plied Gavin with alcohol because of his one kidney and history of cancer. Yet according to their testimony, neither Davalyn nor Starr tell their mother about their sightings of Jackson giving Gavin alcohol, and neither try to intervene to prevent their brother from harming his health by drinking alcohol.
Davalyn describes her family as extremely close, yet she testifies that none of them talked to each other about being held captive, the inappropriate touching she saw, and never talked about Jackson giving Gavin alcohol, which they were later so incensed about. She says they didn't talk about any of it even after their final escape from Neverland.
And despite her emphasis on how close she is to her family, Davalyn repeatedly insists in her testimony that she never talked to her mother or brothers about the Bashir documentary, about the rebuttal video, or about the JCPenney case. This claim of not talking to each other about any of these major events in their lives strikes me as a highly improbable yet legally sensitive claim to make.
Davalyn confirms that she really meant all the kind things she said about Jackson in the rebuttal video filmed on February 20th, in the middle of their stay at Neverland. That she meant all the kind things she said is hard to reconcile with her other testimony that she witnessed Jackson harming Gavin by giving him alcohol before this interview. She also testifies that she was scared and threatened from the very beginning of her stay, yet she says on the stand that she is sincere with all the wonderful things she said about Jackson in her interview 2 weeks into her stay.
Davalyn says definitively that her mother never tried to raise money for Gavin's illness at any time. Mesereau then proceeds to list all the fundraisers that were held to raise money for Gavin's illness, but Davalyn denies knowing that they were fundraisers.
Davalyn says she never talked to her mom about the interview with Child Protective Services they had on February 20th after the rebuttal interview. It's documented that Develin told the social worker that when she visited Neverland, she brought her girlfriend with her. But on the stand in her testimony, she says she lied to the social worker and that she never brought a girlfriend with her. She says her mom lied to the social worker when she said she was always at the main residence at Neverland.
Mazzaro brings up the summer of 2000, when Develin was living with friend of the family, Carol Lemire. Mazzaro asks her if she remembers telling Lemire how it was actually her mother who beat her father, not the other way around, and how her mother beat her sons Gavin and Star. Develin denies saying any of this to Carol Lemire and says Janet is a wonderful mother.
Mazzaro also asks if Develin remembers when social services came to the house years ago because Gavin had accused their mother of abuse. She says she remembers the social worker coming to the house, but nothing else.
Based on the consistent testimony from many other witnesses, including her own family, here are the problems with Develin's testimony.
Develin is lying about her mother only staying in her room the entire time.
She's lying about only ever having alcohol when Jackson gave it to her in the wine cellar.
She is lying about being by herself throughout her stay at Neverland.
She's lying when speaking to the social worker about bringing her friend to Neverland.
She tells the unbelievable story that she never talked to anyone in her family about anything that happened during their stay at Neverland, any interviews they gave, anything at all about the Bashir scene they filmed, or anything about prior lawsuits.
She says she meant all the wonderful things she said about Jackson in her February 20th interview, despite other testimony that she saw Jackson ply her brother with alcohol and touch him inappropriately.
She claims feeling fear since the very first day at Neverland, but somehow she's sincere in her praise of Jackson weeks into her stay. And it contradicts many others who saw her having fun and in a romantic relationship with a Neverland employee. The next day, on March 7th, the prosecution calls its fifth witness, Gavin and Develin's younger brother, Star Arvizo.
At different points in his testimony, 14-year-old Star refers to all the prosecutors by their first names, Tom, Gordon, and Ron. And this small fact came back to me when Chris Tucker later testifies that Star Arvizo is very mature for his age, confident, and cunning.
Prosecutor Sneddon asks Star to describe the two times that he says he saw Jackson molest Gavin.
In the first incident, Star says he left Jackson's room to get chocolate from the theater. And when he returns to the lower part of Jackson's bedroom suite, it sets off the alarm as usual. This is an alarm to alert Jackson when someone enters his bedroom suite. Star goes halfway up the stairs to Jackson's upper bedroom and says he sees a sleeping Gavin facing away on Jackson's bed. He says Jackson was lying next to him, with Jackson's hands inside Gavin's pants, masturbating Gavin and himself. He says he watched for a few seconds and then left and went to the guest unit where his sister was sleeping. He doesn't say anything to his sister, mother, guard, or anyone, and doesn't ever question Gavin about it.
2 days later, Star says the same thing happens again. Star walks into the bedroom suite, alarm goes off, he goes halfway up the stairs and sees Jackson doing the same thing. He watches for a few seconds and goes to sleep in his sister's unit. He doesn't say anything to anyone. When challenged why Jackson didn't hear the alarm to alert him to Star's entrance, Star claims that you can't hear the alarm upstairs because the door at the bottom of the stairs was closed. This will be contradicted by later evidence in court of the alarm testing by Larry Nimmer, demonstrating that the alarm is clearly audible when the lower door is closed.
And logically speaking, what's the point of having an alarm if you can't hear it when the door is closed? It's perfectly reasonable for Michael Jackson to be alerted when someone is walking into his bedroom suite. You can find a link to this alarm test on our website.
Completely contradicting his brother's later testimony about not having the codes, Star says he and Gavin had been into the main house hundreds of times using the codes given to them by Jackson and a security guard.
Star also admits they were caught sleeping in Michael's room without Jackson being present, which contradicts Gavin's later testimony that they were never in Jackson's room when he wasn't there.
Star admits on the stand that he lied under oath in the deposition for his family's JCPenney lawsuit. He says he lied when he testified that his mother and father never fought with each other, and his father never hit him.
Star was clearly following his mother's actions in his lying, because Janet Arvizo also testified in the JCPenney case that her husband was wonderful and there was no marital strife. But once the Arvizos were awarded money from JCPenney, Janet immediately filed for divorce in an apparent attempt to get his share of the settlement money. In her divorce papers, she says she lied in the JCPenney case and that the bruises were not from the guards but from her husband, and he's not wonderful at all. Her children, including Star, all follow suit and reverse their sworn statements about their father.
When Mesereau asks if someone told him to lie in the JCPenney case, Star says he doesn't remember. When asked why he lied under oath, he says he doesn't remember. He also says he can't remember any details about the parking lot incident, even though he was supposedly injured.
The fact that Star Arvizo lied in a prior case that was also for false imprisonment and sexual abuse is one of the many reasons the jury will find Star's testimony untrustworthy.
Star testifies that his sister Davlin got vodka from the kitchen, which contradicts her earlier testimony that she only had wine given to her by Jackson in the wine cellar and otherwise had no alcohol. Star also says he saw his sister Davlin and Marie Cassio sleeping in the theater, which contradicts Davlin's testimony of always staying by herself or being with her mom.
Star denies he and Gavin were caught trying to get into Jackson's briefcase with the adult magazines when Jackson wasn't around. He says he had never seen such magazines before Jackson introduced him to them. Star also says he never cussed before this time with Jackson.
Mesereau notes that in Star's police interview, he claimed that Jackson never let the family know the time. Yet Star acknowledges on the stand that there are clocks all over Neverland, inside and outside, including the huge flower clock, letting him know the time.
Star is questioned about being caught drinking in the wine cellar without Jackson present. Star denies it and says he didn't know where the wine cellar key was kept. However, Mesereau brings forward Star's grand jury testimony, in which he precisely describes the location of this key. Here's what Star said in his grand jury testimony about the wine cellar.
There was an easy way to get in there. The key would be on the hook in the maid's room, because they used to have a resting room there.
Okay, so there was actually a key, and you knew where the key was.
Yeah.
So would it have been possible for you to get the key and go in there if you wanted to?
Yeah.
Mesereau reveals another contradiction when he brings forward Star's police interview. Star told police at that time that before the rebuttal interview, Frank Cassio threatened that if Star and Gavin told the truth about Jackson's molestation, they would go to jail. The problem with Star's account here is that the Arvizos changed their story and are now saying at trial that the molestation didn't happen until after the rebuttal interview, so there would be no truth for Gavin and Star to tell. Star also testifies that Frank said he'll have Star killed, his sister killed, his mother killed, and his grandparents killed. When Star and his siblings talk about the killers and killing, they parrot their mother's words, which reminds me of Jordan Chandler, parroting his father's words in his psychiatrist interview.
In some versions of his story, Star says the kind words he said about Jackson in the rebuttal video were accurate at the time. And then in other testimony, he says it was all lies.
The rebuttal video made by Jackson's team on February 20th is played in court and shows Janet, Davlin, Gavin, and Star all praising Jackson, who is not present.
In this interview, Star says his first impression of Michael was how fatherly he was. When Mesereau questions him on the witness stand about his statement in the video, Star says he was actually talking about his stepfather, Jay Jackson, even though in the interview, Star clearly says the name Michael and he is being asked a direct question about Michael.
It's important to remember when listening to all the positive things Star has to say about Jackson, that before this interview, Star is now claiming to have seen Jackson lick Gavin's head on the flight back to L.A., and ply them both with alcohol every night and show them pornography.
Mesereau brings forth letters from Star and his family to show the jury. Michael, we love you unconditionally, to infinity and beyond forever. Thank you, Michael, for being our family. And in another, when we get our hearts broken in little pieces, we always still love, need, and care about you with every tiny piece of our heart. These were letters written after their first visit to Neverland, when they say Jackson stopped calling them.
Mesereau also brings forward cards the Arvizos sent to Louise Palanker, who they befriended through the Laugh Factory. Here's one example of what they wrote to her.
I think of you every second of my life and pray every night and every morning. I love you. I wish I can spend time with you.
And from another card,
our darling Louise, we love you to the moon and back.
In these cards, the Arvizos address Palanker as Mommy. These letters are used by the defense to support their case that the Arvizos have a pattern, of using flattery and intimate familial language, even when first meeting celebrities, in order to get money and gifts from them.
Just like his sister's testimony on the stand, Starr denies that his mom ever sought funds for Gavin's treatments and blames his dad.
Based on the evidence and testimony brought forward at trial, here are my conclusions about Starr Arvizo's testimony.
He is lying about not knowing where the wine cellar key is, when in earlier testimony he knows exactly where it is.
He's lying when he says that he's not talking about Michael in the rebuttal interview.
He admits to lying in the JCPenney lawsuit.
He contradicts himself by sometimes saying his praise for Jackson was genuine, and at other times saying he was lying.
He admits to being caught in Jackson's room when he wasn't supposed to be there.
He contradicts himself by first claiming that Frank Cascio was threatening them not to reveal Jackson's abuse in the rebuttal interview, but in later testimony says no molestation occurred until after the interview.
He contradicts himself by claiming that Jackson didn't let the Arvizos know the time, while admitting on the stand that there were clocks everywhere telling him the time.
His claim of Jackson first introducing him to cussing or seeing adult magazines will be contradicted by many other witnesses.
His claim of not being able to hear the alarm upstairs in Jackson's bedroom suite is disproven at trial, which discredits his whole story about being able to observe Jackson molest Gavin without being detected. On March 9th, 10th, and 14th, Gavin Arvizo testifies, who was 15 at the time. Just like his brother Starr, at different points in his testimony, Gavin will refer to all three prosecutors by their first names, Tom, Ron, and Gordon, and also refer to his prior civil attorney, Larry Feldman, by his first name. Gavin says under cross-examination that he was angry that Jackson seemed to be avoiding them after that first visit and felt betrayed by his evasiveness. Gavin also testifies that almost everything he told Bashir, including how Jackson helped him, was untrue.
Gavin tells the jury that Jackson was hardly there during his cancer treatments, that it was Chris Tucker and George Lopez who visited him.
Gavin trapped himself here, because if Jackson really didn't help him during his illness, as he is now alleging, then he was lying in all those fawning letters he wrote to Jackson years before the Bashir scandal, letters thanking Jackson for how much he helped him and saying how they considered him a part of their family because of his goodness.
Mesereau brings forward letters that Gavin wrote to Jackson and his kids in the time when Jackson was avoiding the Arvizos and the Arvizos were trying to reconnect with him. Here's some of what Gavin wrote.
Thank you for everything, Daddy Michael. Thank you for being my Daddy Michael. Thank you for showing me how to be happy and beat cancer. Thank you, Daddy Michael, for being my best, best friend forever and ever.
And here's what Gavin wrote to Jackson's assistant, Evie Tavashi.
Evie, sweetheart, we love you.
In her book Conspiracy, Aphrodite Jones describes Gavin as seeming annoyed at Jackson, especially when he recounts how Jackson disappeared after the Bashir filming and didn't see him again until months later when the documentary aired. Gavin also describes his anger when he found out that Jackson was on the ranch, after he had been told that Jackson wasn't there.
Gavin testifies that after the documentary aired, Jackson called them to come to Miami, although Chris Tucker will later testify that Gavin actually called him, trying to find Jackson. Gavin says Jackson gave him wine on the flight back to L.A.
In a police interview from January 2004, Gavin confirms that he and his family were forced to do the rebuttal interview because Jackson already committed the sex abuse. At trial a year later in 2005, Gavin says he still had good things to say about Jackson because the abuse happened after the interview.
Gavin can't keep a consistent motive behind his positive comments of Jackson. Was he praising Jackson in the rebuttal interview because the abuse already happened and he was being forced to say nice things? Or was he praising Jackson because he hadn't been molested yet, and he still thought Jackson was a good person? His changing motives and dates introduce catastrophic credibility problems, and I don't think the media adequately conveyed to the public the damaging implications of Gavin's shifting narrative.
Gavin states that the bedroom alarms can be heard on the second floor of the bedroom, which contradicts earlier testimony by Starr, who said they can't be heard from inside Jackson's bedroom, which is how Starr said he was able to observe Jackson abuse Gavin without Jackson noticing him.
Gavin says the first incident of molestation happened on Jackson's bed and started with Jackson introducing him to masturbation. He says Jackson masturbated him to ejaculation, and he felt weird but didn't tell anyone until he met with psychologist Stan Katz months later. He says he never talked to Starr about the molestation.
Mesereau asks Gavin about why he said in his police interview in 2003 that he didn't drink a lot with Jackson, and now on the stand in 2005 he is saying they drank every night. Gavin doesn't explain the contradictory statements he made, but says it was every night.
At one point in his testimony, Gavin says he told his mother at Neverland they were drinking, but at another point denies telling her about the drinking at all.
Gavin testifies that his mother wanted to leave Neverland during the last days, but that he wanted to stay during the last days because he was having lots of fun. He says that he was happy to be at Neverland all the time. This contradicts his other testimony that he was scared and threatened by the captivity.
Gavin claims that he and his brother Star had never been inside Jackson's bedroom when Jackson wasn't there, but Star testified that he and Gavin did indeed go into Jackson's room when he wasn't there, and they were asked to leave.
Mesereau brings up Gavin's history of disciplinary problems at school, long before the Bashir documentary release. Mesereau cites at least a dozen teachers at one school who wrote up Gavin for consistent discipline issues. One teacher taught ROTC after school and called Gavin totally disruptive. Gavin says on the stand that the other kids were cheering him on because he stood up to the teacher.
Mesereau is able to demonstrate in multiple teacher reports that Gavin stands up to these adults and shows disrespect for their authority and disregard for the rules. Gavin confirms he got complaints from every teacher in school, and one teacher even wrote up that Gavin has good acting skills, not referring to a theater class, but referring to his discipline problem.
These reports were brought forward to bolster the defense argument that Gavin is very tough, street smart, and used to standing up to and disrespecting authority. The reports also counter the prosecution narrative that it was Jackson who caused Gavin to start misbehaving.
The ease and confidence Gavin has with adults is meant to show how he's not as likely to tolerate molestation versus someone who is less confident and more responsive to authority figures. And because he so consistently disregards the rules, it's also meant to show that Gavin would have no qualms about lying under oath, as he provably did in the JCPenney case.
Mesereau plays the rebuttal tape for Gavin in the courtroom, and the jury gets to see Gavin describing Michael as a kind, loving, and humble man, and says he can feel Michael's goodness and happiness. This interview is taken 2 weeks into their stay at Neverland.
Mesereau asks him to confirm if he was being truthful about the praising statements made in this interview. And sometimes Gavin says he was being truthful, and sometimes he says he was lying.
The cross-examination between Mesereau and Gavin gets testy, and Gavin is reported to look very annoyed. At one point, the judge even admonishes them not to argue with each other. Mesereau is trying to have the jury actually see Gavin's confidence with adults, his combativeness, and his ability to stand up to authority, to suggest that it's unlikely that Gavin or his brother would have allowed any molestation quietly.
In his 2004 interview with Mesereau's investigator Scott Ross, Gavin's own father stated that he didn't believe Gavin would tolerate abuse because of his rebellious nature.
The only explanation Gavin gives for why he didn't say anything about the abuse is that he thought his family might get hurt.
Here's Tom Mesereau in 2007, sharing his impressions of Gavin's behavior in the courtroom.
I had studied this child accuser as he responded to the district attorney's questions in direct examination. To me, he was a 13-year-old boy going on 30. In my opinion, this witness was clever, dishonest, deceitful, cool, and with an obvious agenda. He had taken acting lessons and appeared to like being in the spotlight. I sensed this the moment he appeared in the witness box.
Here's a review of some of the problems with Gavin's testimony.
He contradicts his brother's testimony about not being in Jackson's room alone.
He makes contradictory statements about either being scared and threatened at Neverland or having fun every day and not wanting to leave.
Is he drinking every night with Jackson or not a lot?
Did the molestation happen immediately upon arriving at Neverland, or was it at the very end of their stay?
Did he tell his mom about his drinking or not?
Was he forced to make glowing remarks about Jackson, or were they genuine?
For more on the problems with Gavin's testimony, please see the links on our website.
On April 14, 2005, Janet Arvizo begins her testimony, which continues for 4 days and takes up almost 850 pages in the court transcripts.
It's no exaggeration to say that Janet Arvizo's testimony is a disaster for the prosecution. Here's what the New York Times had to say about her testimony.
Janet Arvizo's testimony has been rambling, repetitive, emotional, and at times incoherent. That was under the gentle questioning of the prosecution. Under cross-examination by Mr. Mesereau, Her manner became confrontational. She seldom gave a direct answer to a yes or no question, wagged her finger at Mr. Mesereau, made snide asides to the jury, and lectured the defendant.
Court reporter Aphrodite Jones says Janet Arvizo acts infantile, rarely makes sense, and cries crocodile tears. Jones observes that Janet only looks at the jury, never the lawyer questioning her, and says she is often angry, pointing her finger and snapping at the jury.
The issue of Janet's mental condition was brought up repeatedly behind the scenes in the months leading up to the trial. The defense asserted the following.
The complaining mother is a paranoid schizophrenic with sexual delusions who infuses those delusions on her children.
Paranoid schizophrenia was the opinion of the psychiatrist who evaluated Janet Arvizo in the J.C. Penney case. The defense request to call the psychiatrist as a witness was denied by the court.
Jackson's attorneys requested a mental examination of Janet Arvizo before trial, saying the schizophrenia would compromise Janet's ability to differentiate between her delusions and reality, affecting her competence to stand trial. This mental exam was opposed by the prosecution and eventually denied by the court.
The prosecution counterargued that whether or not she's schizophrenic has nothing to do with whether Michael Jackson was molesting her son. But would a diagnosis of schizophrenia be relevant to her son's accusations? Here's how the American Psychiatric Association describes schizophrenia.
When schizophrenia is active, symptoms can include delusions and hallucinations. Delusions are basically false beliefs and affect the sufferer's ability to perceive reality. A person with schizophrenia will be unwilling to consider other more rational explanations for these beliefs and are generally confrontational when their claims are questioned.
And according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders,
examples of persecutory delusions include being followed, watched, or kept under electronic surveillance. People with schizophrenia can believe their personal safety or even their lives are in danger. Delusions may also appear in bipolar disorder and severe depressive episodes.
A diagnosis of schizophrenia is clearly relevant in a case with allegations of being watched, followed, threatened, or abused, as there are in this case. And if a mother involves her kids in her delusions, then they become susceptible to taking on the delusions as real. The McMartin preschool case is an example in which a mother's schizophrenia is believed to have been a factor in her son's bizarre allegations of sexual abuse by a daycare worker, who was found not guilty and the charges considered baseless. And as we discussed in the Chandler allegations, it was the delusions of Daniel Capon's mother that led him to make false sex abuse claims against Jackson.
Stress can be a trigger that shifts schizophrenia into active mode. So if Janet Arvizo has paranoid schizophrenia, the stress of the media hounding them after the documentary might explain her frequent descriptions of killers coming after her.
And the fact that Jackson's team hired a private investigator to keep tabs on her might lead Janet to misunderstand the intent, believing instead that she's being taken under complete control by Jackson's people.
In a March 2012 article from the Journal of Forensic Psychology Practice, titled Pathways to False Allegations of Sexual Assault, psychotic disorders like schizophrenia are discussed as one of the pathways to false allegations.
Simply because a person has a psychotic disorder in no way implies that an allegation is untrue. But if evidence is found lacking, inconsistent, illogical, or nonsensical, the known mental health disorder of the accuser or the accuser's parents should be taken into consideration. After reading her entire testimony, I found it a shame that the judge did not allow a psychiatric exam of Janet Arvizo, or at least allow the testimony of the psychiatrist who thought she had paranoid schizophrenia. Without any consideration for her mental health, Janet Arvizo humiliates herself with bizarre testimony and behavior, like snapping her fingers at the jury. She makes herself a subject of media derision. Her testimony is a painful read and left me disgusted with the prosecution, who resisted an evaluation that may have helped Janet Arvizo, or at least prevented this public humiliation. We'll begin with Janet's testimony about her family's very first visit to Neverland back in 2000.
Janet, who has been characterized by many witnesses as very talkative, charming, and engaging, testifies that she never spoke a word to Michael Jackson on that very first visit to Neverland when Gavin had cancer, even though we know they all spent the day together and had dinner together.
Janet says she had no input when Gavin was asking to stay in Jackson's suite that night. This contradicts Frank Cascio's account that Janet was eagerly supporting her kid's request to stay with Jackson and that Jackson felt she was pushing her kids on him.
After the Bashir documentary airs and the Arvizos go to Miami to see Michael Jackson, Janet testifies that Jackson told them they were in danger and they needed protection from the killers. Also in Miami, she says Jackson associate Ron Conitzer told her he could have her erased if she made him angry.
Janet testifies that on the flight back to L.A. from Miami, she decides to get up and see what was going on. So she gets up and says she sees Jackson repeatedly licking Gavin's head. Her son, Star, who was sitting elsewhere, is the only other person to claim witnessing the head-licking, despite having many others on this flight, including Jackson's doctor facing him on the plane, his nannies close around him, and the flight attendant who says she kept her eyes on Jackson for pretty much the entire 5-hour flight. It's only Janet and Star who witness the head-licking. However, they never discuss it with each other or say anything to Gavin or Jackson and continue to praise Jackson as a father figure.
Janet says after arriving at Neverland, she stays in her guest bedroom and had no idea where her boys slept. She claims she never had any contact with them during their stay. This contradicts many other witnesses, including the ranch manager, who will testify that Janet joined her kids and the Cascios for dinner in the main house, with Jackson there on occasion.
Janet confirms other witness testimony that Davelin hung out with Marie Cascio during their stay, which contradicts Davelin's testimony that she was always alone at Neverland.
Jackson investigator Bradley Miller did an interview with the Arvizos on February 16th, 4 days before the rebuttal interview. Janet's boyfriend, Major Jackson, was also present at the Miller interview. Her boyfriend will later work for the prosecution in setting up surveillance on Miller before the raid on Miller's office. If either Janet or her boyfriend had knowledge that Miller worked for Jackson's lawyer Garagos, the raid of his office could be considered illegal because of attorney-client privilege. But Janet testifies at trial that she never understood that Brad Miller worked with Jackson's lawyer Mark Garagos. The jury then hears the following from the beginning of the recorded interview.
I am Brad Miller, licensed private investigator working on behalf of the law firm Garagos & Garagos, specifically for an attorney named Mark Garagos, who is an attorney for Michael Jackson. And this is being tape recorded with your permission. And then you hear Janet Arvizo answer yes on the recording.
Miller repeats this very same identification statement at the end of the interview. And Janet Arvizo again acknowledges that Miller works for Jackson's lawyer Garagos. Janet says she did this interview with Miller to appease the killers. She says she was fed all the information to say in that recorded interview. But confusingly, she also says that everything nice she said about Jackson, she said straight from the heart, that it was not scripted, it was all accurate. Here's an excerpt from the recorded interview with Miller.
Michael's everything that an ultimate father is. And that's what the children have always prayed for, is a father, and that God has blessed them with. And me, I've always wanted a family, so he's family to me. In being what I endured in 17 years, I would be the most sensitive to any little thing. And Michael has never, absolutely never, made me feel in any way, form, shape, or matter that anything was anything different other than Gavin as a son to Michael, Star as a son to Michael, Davelin as a daughter to Michael, and Michael like a father to all three of them.
This interview was on February 16th, so after she claims she saw the licking incident, and after she alleges she was frightened and in captivity at Neverland and not allowed to see her own kids. Because Janet says her answers in the Miller interview were true and from the heart. Mesereau then questions her statement that the rebuttal interview was scripted and performed under force, which was only 4 days after the Miller interview.
Mesereau lists the names of 4 different Neverland employees who made statements about their interactions with Janet during this time period. And one of these statements is that Janet said to an employee that she wanted her kids on TV with Jackson. In another, she allegedly complained to an employee that Jackson had promised to take care of her, and now she knew it wasn't going to happen. Janet denies these statements.
Mesereau also brings forward testimony from the Arvizo's former dance teacher. This teacher said that Janet called her during this time of alleged captivity, complaining about the media and saying she wanted to get out of the country. She says Janet told her that the people around Jackson kept him in the dark and that he's clueless.
Mesereau questions Janet about some recorded phone calls between her and Jackson assistant Frank Cassio. These calls were recorded while Janet was at her boyfriend's house after what she calls her first escape from Neverland.
By Janet's own account, she was scared during these phone calls with Frank, who she says had been threatening her to do the rebuttal video. But on the tape played for the jury, Janet betrays no fears and appears to be buttering up Frank to get something from him.
"I love you so much. You don't know how much I love your little sister and your little brother. It's like we're family, you know, Frank? And people don't understand that."
Mesereau is aiming to show how Janet Arvizo uses overly effusive language to ingratiate herself with targeted people, to get what she wants in an indirect manner. On this recording, Janet tells Frank about how reporters are calling her constantly with lucrative offers.
"It's like crazy. Can I read you one of the letters? It's like there are all kinds of things, and it's of no interest to me because family never leaves family behind."
Janet implies how she could be making lots of money with all these offers from the tabloids, but she would never do that because we're family, in an apparent attempt to get a monetary offer by Frank. This is the same time period when her boyfriend Jay Jackson is directly asking Frank for money for the rebuttal interview, which you'll hear about in his own testimony. 4 days after the Miller interview, the Arvizos do the rebuttal interview. Janet testifies that she was told to do the rebuttal video to appease the killers. She testifies that Jackson, Conitzer, Wisner, Frank Cassio, and Vinny Amen all talked about killing, and they ended up being the killers. She says Conitzer and Wisner told her they could make her kids disappear. And if she did a good job with the rebuttal video, she didn't have to leave the country.
Mesereau shows the jury that while Janet Arvizo was taking her time deciding whether or not to film the rebuttal tape, in the meantime she was shopping, getting beauty treatments like a leg wax, getting her son's orthodontic work done, all on Jackson's tab. Records were brought into court showing Janet Arvizo charging thousands for makeup and other beauty products and treatments to Jackson during this time period.
The rebuttal interview was finally made several weeks into their stay at Neverland, and it was too late to go on the outtake footage sold to Fox.
Janet Arvizo testifies to many contradictory things about the making of this rebuttal video. Janet says it was all scripted, and that even her laughter is scripted. However, she also testifies that she had no problem saying these nice things about Jackson because she had nothing negative to say about Jackson at the time of the rebuttal. She confirms she was ready to do a documentary about Jackson where all she had were beautiful things to say. She doesn't explain why she would have to be forced to say nice things if she still thought highly of Jackson at that point.
After the rebuttal interview, the Arvizos were interviewed by social workers at Janet's boyfriend's house. Another occasion in which they all said positive things about Jackson. They next went with Frank and Vinny Amen to get passports for the trip to Brazil and stayed about 5 nights in Calabasas without Jackson present. Janet testifies that she was told the killers had arrived in Neverland, so she had to go to Calabasas.
Regarding the Brazil trip, Janet's story is that Jackson and associates wanted to send her and her family to Brazil permanently. The Jackson side of the story is that the trip was something Janet wanted to do because it would relieve some of the media pressure. Mesereau shows the court a printed itinerary that Janet confirms she had seen, saying the trip was planned from March 1st to March 6th.
Janet claims that Frank threatened that her parents and boyfriend would be killed if the Arvizos didn't go to Brazil. She claims that she was forced to sign all the documents like visas and passports for the trip while being followed by killers who trailed her from building to building in Calabasas.
Janet Arvizo is asked to confirm the following statements, which were made by her friend Aja Pryor in a police interview. Aja Pryor was the spouse of Chris Tucker at the time and befriended Janet through him.
Pryor said that Janet actually invited her to go to Brazil with them and was very excited about the trip. But once Janet found out Jackson wasn't going, Janet decided she wasn't going either. And so the Arvizos never made the trip. According to Pryor, Janet complained that Jackson's associates were making a lot of money on the rebuttal footage, and her family wasn't getting anything. She also complained to Pryor that the Germans were keeping her and her family away from Jackson.
On the stand, Janet denies making any of these statements. Janet claims she told Aja Pryor that she was being held against her will at Neverland and was hoping Pryor would call police.
Janet confirms that in her police interview, she said that Jackson associates threatened that they had various ways to make her children disappear, including the power to fly them away from Neverland in a hot air balloon. But at a separate point in her testimony, the hot air balloon is part of a different story, as her planned escape from Neverland.
After they all left Neverland, March 12th, Janet testifies that she is still being followed by Jackson's people and claims that she wanted her lawyer, William Dickerman, to help her with this. However, Dickerman testifies that she never mentioned being followed, nor is it noted in any of the legal correspondence between him and Jackson's attorney, Garagos.
Janet also gives testimony about her $3 million lawsuit against JCPenney, which was settled out of court for $152,000. We've already covered the basics of what happened, with Gavin stealing clothes and security guards following him, leading to some kind of scuffle in the parking lot and the arrest of the parents. Janet denies needing medical care, and her booking photo shows her looking neat and unbruised. And then Janet brings photos a week later with bruises.
According to her husband at the time, David Arvizo, Janet has the kids rehearse a story about the guards beating them all up, and then 9 months later she files her lawsuit claiming battery and loss of earnings because she was unable to work afterwards. When Gavin was diagnosed with cancer a year later, she amended her complaint to add sexual assault charges.
In her filing for the JCPenney lawsuit, she claims that the injuries Gavin sustained in the parking lot made his cancer worse, even though the JCPenney incident occurred 2 years before he got cancer.
Mesereau reveals to the jury that Gavin was deposed in this JCPenney lawsuit during the peak of his illness while he was still in the hospital. And according to Gavin's father, this was to make him a more sympathetic figure to a potential jury and to force JCPenney to settle. David Arvizo said that his wife, Janet, instructed a nurse to give Gavin medication, and Janet told Gavin to act tired and fatigued during his questioning in the lawsuit.
Mesereau has Janet confirm the details of her accusations in the JCPenney lawsuit.
In her lawsuit, Janet claimed that she was clobbered by the guards, who broke her hand and hit her face. She said there was a guard that got behind her, hand on her chin, grabbed her hair and twisted her head from side to side. She said her head twisted like an exorcist. She claimed she was dragged on the ground and that the security guards were calling her different obscenities. She claimed she saw her husband David being choked. She said a guard was hitting her repeatedly over the head with handcuffs, and then a guard started touching her breast and genital area for minutes at a time. She said she was choked, kneed, and scratched. She said she thought she was going to die by the assault, and it was like she was in a cave in a tunnel. She claimed in her lawsuit that the guards were doing belly flops on top of her body, and she was punched with handcuffs like they were brass knuckles. She claimed the guards beat her son Star and pressed Gavin's face in vomit. She said the guards spit pumpkin seeds at them.
Janet showed no bruises or other signs of injury in her police booking photos, but she testifies that the bruises showed up later. She denied needing any care for herself or her kids at the police station.
Janet admits on the stand that she lied in that lawsuit and that the bruising was from her husband, not the security guards. Although in her JCPenney lawsuit, Janet and her kids say there were no marital problems and no abuse, in her divorce document filed 5 days after winning the settlement money, she said her husband threatened to kill her and the kids. She said he threatened to have his brother kill them.
During cross-examination, we learned that in her divorce filing under penalty of perjury, Janet did not disclose the financial assistance she was receiving from her fiancé.
Mesereau brings forward a photo where Janet is holding a knife in a threatening manner. She says she was joking in that picture. He brings up a few other photos where she is doing the same thing with other objects, and she says she is joking.
Janet testifies that she never asked for money for Gavin's illness because their insurance paid. Yet she did set up a fund for Gavin because of his illness. She admits that this bank account for Gavin's benefit was never used for medical expenses, and that she was in control of the funds.
Janet was revealed at trial to have laundered her money through her parents' account to keep her money hidden, and her fiancé Jay Jackson did the same. She was also found to have taken her welfare checks and deposited them in her fiancé's account to hide them.
Based on the consistent testimony of many other witnesses, here's a rundown of Janet Arvizo's apparent false statements and dubious claims.
She lied about never asking for money for Gavin's illness.
She lied about the cost of cancer treatment.
She lied about telling her own attorney that Jackson's people were following her.
She lied about staying in her room and not seeing her kids during her Neverland stay.
She admits she was using funds raised for Gavin's illness for non-medical purposes.
Janet admits she lied in the JCPenney lawsuit And we find out her kids also lied for financial gain in this lawsuit, so it's a clear example of how Janet brings her kids into a world of grift and apparent delusions.
We get a sense of her ability to tell bizarre lies, like the security guards doing belly flops on her, or twisting her head around like an exorcist. Even though her police booking photos show not a hair out of place, no bruises or torn clothing, and she says she is in no need of medical care.
She's caught on tape using flattery to get money from Frank Cassio, saying how she wouldn't betray him because he's family, even though she's got all these offers from the media for cars and money.
She makes contradictory statements about why she praises Jackson in all the interviews. She says the Miller interview was genuine, but 4 days later she had to be forced to use a script to say nice things, and even the laughter was scripted. But then she says she did believe all the nice things she said, even though at the same time she was claiming that she was scared and imprisoned by Jackson.
The most important issue with Janet Arvizo's testimony is how it's relevant to Gavin's accusations of sex abuse. In interviews after the trial, the prosecution will try to argue that Janet's flawed testimony and behavior don't have relevance to the credibility of Gavin's sex abuse charges. But to me, the relevance is obvious. Janet brings her children into her world of grift and delusions. The children go right along with her story of captivity, being scared and threatened, even though there's overwhelming evidence to contest this claim. Under her influence, her children lied in the JCPenney lawsuit, where they told dramatic stories about how this JCPenney incident was scarier and more traumatic than Gavin's cancer. You'll hear many more stories from defense witnesses about how the children play central roles in Janet's grifting schemes. And that concludes our summary of the Arvizos' testimony. Even before hearing any defense witnesses, the Arvizos, through their own testimony, have discredited themselves. They make many provable false statements. They have a history of lying for money. Their stories are not only nonsensical, such as being held captive to do an interview they were willing to do anyway, but contradictory, both within their own stories and between each other's stories. Just like in the Chandler case, the Arvizos' own words reveal their deceit.
Although the Arvizos all self-destructed under cross-examination, the prosecution has about 80 other witnesses to try to bolster their case.
In the next episode, we'll cover the remaining prosecution witnesses. Will their evidence support the Arvizos' claim of captivity? Will the witnesses from the Chandler case prove Jackson's propensity to commit molestation? Will the prosecution have anything to show for the dozens of experts they bring forward to testify?
We'll take you through the prosecution evidence and continue their case against Michael Jackson.
We'd like to thank the following websites for their analysis and collection of court documents, which helped guide my research. The Michael Jackson Allegations, Vindicating Michael, and Reflections on the Dance. You can reach out to us and find all our sources on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseFurnessons.com.
You can reach out to us through our website or on Twitter at Case4Innocence. Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.